Hello everyone, this is Mike Quincy, Connecting the Light. My guest today is James O'Conn. He's studied likes to study the technology of people, and he's had a lifelong passion for Maya archaeology. And with his engineering talents for some 40 years, he has explored and investigated Maya sites located deep in the jungle. With that, we have his new book called The Lost Secrets of Maya Technology, which we are going to have a talk about. So welcome to the program, Jim.
Thank you.
Now, I guess most people, that includes me, would like to know where this all began for you, because I see you say you've had a lifelong passion. And I wonder what's really started that off for you.
I grew up in a small town in Georgia that was part of the Civil War battlefields, well, the American Civil War in the 1860s, and I played in the trenches, and in the 1940s you could still find rusted armament and spent shells, and that got me interested in history. And of course, the city I lived in was the only American city ever destroyed by war. That's Atlanta. And one thing led to another, and because I had a lack of historical background in reality, all my history came virtually from books. Authors who wrote about the conquest and European history, et cetera, and I really started in Iberia. I spent a year in Spain and came back to the United States. And after a year or so, I took a year-long sabbatical. This is in my 20s. And where I took my family, myself, and a brand-new Volkswagen camper and headed south of the border, down into the Yucatan, where I lived among the Maya cities for almost a year and studied the sites, which at that time, and I'm only talking about 40 years ago, not much was known about them because they were rediscovered in the mid-19th century, but due to civil unrest, et cetera, there was not much known about them, and the code for breaking their hieroglyphics was only broken in the 60s and 70s, so 1960s and 70s, so I sort of learned along with the archaeologist, and the thing that started my quest to solve the technological issues was questions I asked of archaeologists at the sites in regard to how did they make that cement for the concrete. And they said, there's no cement for concrete here. They were Stone Age people. I said, well, what about those tools that must have been really sharp to carve these unbelievable, concise drawings? He said, they just used flint tools. So I knew these were not the right answers, so I started looking for my own. And the first big discovery was in the 80s. And I took it from there, and the number of what I found to be surprising and amazing piece of technology grew into a book, the one that you may be holding now.
Right. Well, there's certainly a lot of knowledge and experience gone into that. You mentioned about the cement, and I know you've got a lot more to tell about that. But what is your understanding of how they were able to produce such a hard cement?
Well, it's the concrete that's hard. Cement is a powder that you mix with water and sand, et cetera.
Right.
Everybody makes that mistake, Mike. You know, I hear it on the news all the time, and they had a cement dam. I'm going, no, it's a concrete dam. Cement used to make concrete.
Right.
Somehow, and I can't tell you how, they developed a blast furnace, which the British invented, and they developed the technique of using wood stacked in a cylindrical assembly, 20 feet in diameter, maybe 10, 12 feet high, with a fire hose, a cylinder down the middle. And on top of this assembly, they would stack chunks of limestone. I'm using chunks. They were like 6 inches by 6 inches. And they would light this fire. And what would happen was, because the fire in the center of this, which is a thermodynamic reactor, would start fire, would temperature would raise, and the pressure would lower, and the lower pressure would suck in cold oxygen-rich air from the outside and cause the fire to burn hotter, and that would draw in more air, and the cycle continued until the system had developed about 1400 to 1600 degrees Celsius, which is enough to melt limestone, and melted limestone actually becomes cement in a chemical process. So after it was all over, they let it cool off, and basically they had the cement that they mixed with other materials, the aggregates, et cetera, to make their concrete. And they use these in their structures, their high-rise structures, their temples, the pyramids, et cetera, by basically using two thin outer walls of stone and filling the inside with concrete, which is made with the cement. And then, in our world, we call it the European world, we didn't invent the process for cement until Joseph Asplund in England in 1821. Now, the Romans had some cement, and they used it in their structures, but it was a natural cement. They mined from the ground near the Mount Vesuvius and other volcanoes, and when it ran out, that was the end of their supply. So the Maya fabricated methodologies, and one of the elements in the book is I emulated this process by developing a scale model, which was on the History Channel, and then I had some really great guys from some professors from the Autonomous University of Mexico that ran physical and chemical tests on the cement and proved that it was very similar to modern Portland cement that we all use throughout the world, the most popular building material in the world now, and it was back in the days of the Maya. That's the short answer, anyway, if it was short.
Right. Now, you mentioned about the fabrication of tools that are harder than iron, and specialized jade tools, which also are harder than iron. Were they unique to the Mayans, or were they, in fact, using some sort of technology that other people didn't have at that time?
Other people had used the obsidian blade. There were some European cultures that discovered that obsidian is a volcanic glass, and when you chip off a piece of obsidian, you could get down to almost molecular-sized edge, which makes it the sharpest blade in the world. In fact, it's used presently in modern surgery, in eye surgery and in thoracic surgery, because it's so sharp. It's 100 times sharper than a steel scalpel. But as far as the using the jadeite for specialized tools that were chisels and awls and gouges and axes, adzes, the whole thing, the Maya were unique in that area. Now, the Moai of New Guinea did use some tools made out of jadeite. But see, jadeite is only found in two or three places around the world in any kind of quantity. So the Maya did not have any metal ore within 1,500 miles of their homeland. So they did have one of the rare occurrences of jadeite, and they first used it as a jewelry, unbelievably hard to work, because as I say in the book, it's harder than iron. It's like 7 on the Mohr scale. And they developed the systems of tool systems that are so similar to modern chisels and gouges and everything you can imagine, drills, that it's uncanny. In fact, I show a lot of those in my book, the photographs, but in my PowerPoint, which I'm showing at the Explorers Club in New York next month, I actually have comparisons between, you know, photos of Maya tools and modern tools made in like Czechoslovakia, and they're so similar, it's almost uncanny. So, yes, they developed really specialized tools for carving stone, and their artwork is just unbelievable, and it's otherworldly and exotic, and it's even after 1,200 years in being in the jungle after the abandonment, they are still, many of them are still very concise and clear.
Right. Is it known where the Mayans actually came from?
Well, the best guess, and I'm telling you, going back 25,000 years, they were part of the migration that came over the Bering land bridge from Siberia. And their DNA is indicated Mongolian and Siberian and Chinese type of genes in their system. But they don't seem to find any others. There's some theories that possibly some Europeans migrated from the east, but the Maya physically do not have any European characteristics. They're rather short. They've got a very particular facial characteristics. But the best bet is they found their way south from the Bering Land Bridge, through Canada, down through North America. They are in North America, by the way. And found a really nice place to settle down in the Yucatan with its rainforest and stayed. That was 3,000 years before they had a 3,000-year civilization before the collapse. And that was, you know, 1,100 years ago. So we're talking about 4,000 years of civilization. It still goes on. It's not the big, brilliant civilization they had before 900 A.D., before the failure, but it's a cultural thing. But the big cities were abandoned about 900 and never reoccupied.
Right. Now, how far along the line in your expeditions was it that you saw the two towers that led you to discover that they had actually built a suspension bridge?
I was, it was 1989, so we're looking now at 23 years ago, about halfway through my period. It was about a period of exploration and discovery. And I was in a dugout canoe, classic. So you could look at any British explorer story, wearing a bush jacket, which it was affectation, in a dugout canoe, drinking a cold beer. Well, it was cold. We had a cooler on board. And we landed at the site. We were landing at the site of the city of Yaxchilán, a city that was a classic period that also demised around 900. And I saw, as we were landing, a circular ruin near the banks, about 25 yards from the banks of the south side of the river. This is a big river, 300 feet near a normal size. And I looked to my right, and I saw the vestiges of another pier. And I guess I made the statement, typical me, I think the mines had a bridge here. And I was told I was absolutely crazy by the archaeologists because these were Stone Age people, and they wouldn't have the capabilities of doing any technology of that sort. Well, their city is located on a big omega, a big loop in the river. And during the rainy season, it becomes basically an island. And there's no way to get on or off the island for 6 months because of the 600 expanded river, 600 feet, and the 15-mile-an-hour flow and huge trees floating down the river. So they had to, my first premise was to prove that the Maya of that city had to have a lifeline, some way to get on and off the river, I mean, across the river, on off the Oxbow, right, onto the mainland where their hinterland and their agriculture and their small cities were, and they needed a bridge. And then after I'd done some research and had some aerial photos flown, this is before we had Google Earth. Right now I could zoom in on them and see everything that I wanted to see, but I located the two structures in the river and I went back again and did a little diving and surveying up on the banks of the city and along the edge of the river. And after two or three visits, located three major structures and tied them all together with a straight, absolutely straight line along the center lines. One was the structure 5 on the plaza, which was their esplanade, the entrance, and the two structures in the river. Now, people say, why don't you explore on the Guatemalan side? Well, at this time, there was a civil war going on, and the rebels had planted landmines on the other side. I may be a little crazy. I may have a little courage, but I'm not crazy enough to step on a landmine, as many people did, several, a handful, okay? Yeah, because they wouldn't take the warnings. But if I have a big blank on the other side or I make up something, it's because I didn't go on that side to explore. Because now that they've found all the landmines by stepping on them, which is not a very good way of doing it, the river took out any of the structures that were over there. But anyway, having these elements, the only thing that would work with those spans, it was 206 feet to the center span, three-span bridge, was a suspension bridge. And by chance, they had the strongest rope in the world in the Yucatan. This is the same rope that the British used and the whole world used for all their sailing ships in the 18th, 19th, and halfway through the 20th century. The hemp rope, the manila rope is the same thing because they took the plants over to the manilas to grow those. And they had a suspension bridge that looks like the Golden Gate, you know, three spans with a wooden walkway. And that was their solution. And so far, so good. The science has accepted it because it seemed logical and they needed a bridge. Archaeology is trailing a little behind, but they're not into technology much as it is. Most archaeologists, this is not a slam, do not have technical training. They become anthropologists or art history majors to get their PhD, and then they become archaeologists.
What surprises me is that in that particular period of time, they were able to fit a suspension system in place over quite a large distance. And I'm sort of wondering how did they start about that? I mean, how do you set about linking two towers together?
Well, these people, and this was built about between 600 AD and 700 AD, were really smart. They had 3,000 years of study and developing, you know, unbelievable astronomy, which is, periodicities is equal to our present calculations with digital equipment and an elegant mathematics system that would take figures to the 30 decimal point, not decimal point, 30 figure mark. And one of the original five written languages in the world. So these guys they developed the number zero before everybody else, before the Hindus, before the Hindus gave it to the Arabs, and the Arabs gave it to the Italians. And they were smart, and they knew how to do their engineering, and they knew how to do a lot of things that covering a vote book about their how they survived in a very difficult climate using technology. So the fact that they use hammocks might have given some guy an idea that, you know, these ropes might be really good to suspend from the land to the first tower and then between the middle two towers and then the other tower. In fact, in the 1800s, I have read accounts of people viewing suspension bridges that were being made on a smaller scale, maybe 80 feet long. And then I have a photograph in the book of, in 1875, of Maya, who are building suspension bridges across the river. They're only footbridges, but let me tell you, this is about the same time the Brooklyn Bridge was opened up, and it didn't have a looping parabolic suspension system. We used straight lines, but that was the first of these suspension bridges developed by what I call Europeans. So that, I believe that the suspension bridge has been in their book of tricks for well over 1,500 years. So they knew how to suspend structures using ropes. So I think they just extrapolated and built this bridge.
Yes, because I know that you've mentioned they also built medium span and short span bridges. So the suspension bridge you're talking about was by no means the only one, evidently.
No, and one of the elements about the Yucatan, there's very few geologic devices like ravines. Like the Inca had bridges, but they had lots and lots of mountains and river chasms to cross. The Maya land is almost totally flat. And there's very few bodies of water that you encounter because of the, as explained in the book, the soil absorbs all the rain right away and it goes into a porous limestone subbase which then flows directly into the aquifer. So they don't have any open bodies of water. So they didn't have many opportunities to build long bridges. Now, I talk about the short span, those are over streams or entering cities, and the medium spans, which were over small rivers, and they were all clever, and they were quite ahead of their time. But the big one was the suspension bridge at Yashilan.
Now, I believe you also mentioned that they built multi-story structures. Was that unusual in their particular time?
If you compare Europe, the Maya cities were, the big cities, were larger than anything in Europe, about 100,000 people. Now, that's what drives people to build tall buildings, that and pride. You know, a king says, I'm going to really have a nice palace, so he builds a multi-story palace. And they, I say multi-story, they were 3 to 5 to 7 stories high, which is higher than basically anybody in the European class of people built out of concrete until the 18th century in Chicago, where they sort of invented the skyscraper. And yes, they were unique. The Leaning Tower of Pisa is barely, I think it's 100 feet high, and some of these Maya structures are easily that high. And you know, they had stairways, internal stairways, and external stairways, and it was mostly palaces and administration buildings that were built multi-story. And they were all show. They were all every king wanted to have a taller pyramid. They're called Ahu, the king. And he wanted to have a bigger, more grand palace. I mean, some of the palaces had 200 rooms in them. They may not have been but 3 stories high, but that's still a big that's a big house. So they were very large on building grand palaces and tall ones at that.
Yes, another thing that surprises me is that you mentioned they mainly use their concrete constructions by using cast in concrete.
Cast in place? Okay, yes, that they would, with rare exceptions, they used cast in place concrete. They'd start the construction with two stone facings and then pour maybe 3 feet or a meter of concrete in between with some large aggregate and tamp it down. So the concrete would bond to the inside of these stones, which had pinions or an element that stuck into the concrete. And then they'd do another level of 3 feet and another level of 3 feet. And then they'd start, when you get about 8 or 9 feet high, they would start with their spring line of the dome structures, the vault structures, the Piedmont, I'm sorry, the Maya arch, which is a really very unique structure, and it is a self-standing arch as opposed to other arches needing some kind of external system. They might use a very high-strength beam across the inside, about 8 feet high, and these beams are about 18,000 PSI, which is like strength of steel, and lasted. Some of them are still in place after 1,400 years in some of the sites, and some of the pictures of them are in the book. So these things impress me. And, of course, since I am basically a structural engineer, but most of the things we talk about in the book are structural and civil engineering, the water systems and the cement and the tools, et cetera, all lend themselves to the bag of tricks that civil engineers have in their repertoire as they go about their business today. You know, and they were the first civil engineers in Europe also. I mean, we got guys like Michelangelo and the military engineers that became, in our case, the Corps of Engineers, and they were mostly castle builders and building builders, and anything you needed to build would have been a civil engineering feat.
Fine. Now, would you say that their water reservoirs were any different to anybody else's? I mean, that sounds quite an achievement as well.
It was. There was basically four elements they used. One was a natural well. These are very big wells called I think we're naming them anyway. Cenotes. And they're natural wells that were formed when the what's called the Chicxulub meteor strike exploded on the surface of the Yucatan 65 million years ago. Now, this is the meteor that gets credit for destroying the dinosaurs. But what it did, it also fractured the structure of the limestone subbase. And over the years, that's 65 million years, they begin to dissolve and turn into big, like 100 feet across wells, went down to the aquifer so you could reach the water. Now about 2,000 of these are located in the very northern extreme of the Yucatan. Then we had a water collection system that was where you built your city with all the roofs and the ground sloping towards underground collection systems called chaltuns. And the chaltuns held about 40,000 liters each. And depending on your city, you would collect water during the rainy period to use during the dry period. I haven't mentioned yet that the rainy period, I did it with the bridge, but it's 6 months long, and you get 100 inches or more of rain. And then during the six-month dry period, you have a virtual desert because there isn't any rain falling. So you have to, Maya engineers and their technology had a really good system, depending on where you were, for collecting water during the rainy season and saving it for the dry season so it could be retrieved and used for drinking water and for agriculture. Now, they did have a reserve. Most of the cities that I've calculated, other people have calculated, had about an 18-month reserve. So if it didn't rain for a year, they were covered. Didn't rain for a year and a half, they were okay. But if it went any longer, as it did at the end of the story, when the worst drought in 7,000 years came along, they ran out of water. But the third way is open reservoirs. In these places where they had these open reservoirs, they use urban scapes where they actually shaped the ground that the Acropolis and the temples and the different buildings of the city, all the buildings would be sloped towards the outside, and the outside ground would be sloped downhill, and there would be culverts and catches to collect this water at a higher ground. And during the dry season, there were sluice gates and dams and weirs and all kinds of water manipulation mechanisms that we still use today that allow them to let water flow into the agricultural fields and for water. And for their clean their water, to filter their water, they used, particularly open reservoirs, they used water lilies, which the leaves were spread out and they would wind up cutting down the amount of evaporation. And a water lily, because of its organic nature, actually cleans the water by its system. I won't go into the details now, but that was a very clever system. Now, modern cities are using organic methods of cleaning water, and they're using lilies and the lily pads to clean the water. And the last one is aqueducts. So this only happened in a couple of places where they had more water than they could use. And this is where they built a series of underground structures similar to the Maya Arch. The water flowed through it. And in some places they lowered or diminished the size of the opening so the water would back up and cause a head up, a pressure head. And it was allowed to flow into the palaces where they had running water for fountains and domestic use, as well as a toilet. So they were pretty adept in some areas. And that was the way they solved that problem, using whatever worked in there. If it was a flat area, they used underground concrete, cast-in-place concrete reservoirs, and if it was in hilly ground, they could use the open reservoirs. Mike?
I was going to say, that's very interesting. And having seen a list of their agricultural products, it wouldn't be out of place today, would it?
Not at all. In fact, the agricultural products of the Maya are really interesting. I didn't even state this in the book, but 60% of the world's foodstuffs were developed by the Maya. I mean, invented. Not that they were some wild corn or tomatoes or avocados or pineapples or you name chocolate growing around. They actually use agronomy to develop these plants from wild species and into what we know today. Most of the species that came from the Maya would be recognizable today. Of course, corn has 7,000 kinds now because everybody in the world's worked on it for different kinds of stuff, but they had an amazing selection of produce that the world used. Tobacco, throw that in cotton, go on and on.
Yes, they were certainly, I think, full of good ideas. And another one that I think was quite surprising, knowing how difficult it must be to make a pathway through it, is the way they use elevated roadways as well.
That's true. The elevated part, the minimum of 1 meter above the surface of the jungle, and 10 meters wide, they had four lanes, and they paved it with this concrete we're talking about. They made a very smooth pavement. In fact, the roads are called Sakpe Obs. Sakpe is a singular, and that means white road. And these roads were made out of the cement, which is a very white cement, and it would reflect the light of the sun and the stars and moon at night, so you could travel 24 hours a day on these roads. And being elevated during the rainy season, you could travel full speed ahead during the rain because they were built with crowns on the top of the roads, on the pavements. So they drained, and you basically had a dry pavement like we are supposed to have now, except when you run through the puddles, right? But they were great. And I've explored several of them, and the most famous one is the 100-meter stockade between Koba and Yashuna, but there's another 300-kilometer road from Merida down to the coast that's called the Pilgrim's Road. But these structures for roadways, and I call them structures because they were built up, they weren't, are harder to find because they'd be covered by the jungle for 1,000 years. And unlike a pyramid or a city, which has got lots of structures sticking through the, you know, the accumulated debris. And but they've been located all over the Maya land, in Honduras and Guatemala, all over Mexico. And there was, I'd literally thousands of miles of these, which took a tremendous amount of work to build.
Were they also very adept at providing facilities for their sea trade? I mean, did they have a sort of very modern port, is what one might say?
That was a question about marine trade?
Yes, yes.
Okay, yeah, they did use a dugout structure for the main part of their seagoing vessels. I hate to call them canoes. They were 60 to 80 feet long and 80 feet wide. That's more than a canoe. But they would, actually did a drawing, an engineering plan in the book, where I show the gunnels and the flat bottom for stability and all kinds of elements that the boats had that they developed over 1,000 years. In fact, these boats are still running and operating for 500 years after the collapse because our most trustworthy, I guess you're calling trustworthy, observer of a Maya trade canoe was Christopher Columbus on his fourth voyage. He encountered an 80-foot long canoe, which is actually longer than his boat. Galleys were big boats, and they only gave Columbus small boats. But he was a surprise. He boarded it and took off a whole series of what he considered valuable commodities, including bolts of cotton, which were absolutely unknown in Europe. But they were so fine, and it's the same cotton we use today. 90% of the cotton in the world is made from the strain that the Maya developed. But anyway, he took off other things, like cacao beans, which he didn't think anything of. They were just little beans, but the Maya valued them highly because they used those as money. So we know that they had the boats, and they were had cabins on them, and 30 rowers and passengers, et cetera. But you start, in my calculations, they could carry 24 tons of materials. That's a lot of load for a canoe. So they traded up and down the coast of Central America, all the way down to Panama. They had a really good navigation system with the stars. They were great astronomers. That took about 300-kilometer voyages across the Caribbean to Antigua. They found materials on the island of Antigua that are definitely traced back to Maya sources, like some jade axes, et cetera. So they had quite a... Oh, and there's all kinds of anecdotal stories about them trading with Florida and the Indians there. But they did have a flourishing sea trade, and they kept it up until the Spanish outlawed them from trading, and they only used the boats for, like, coastal freighters after that.
Right. Did you get into other aspects of the Mayan history, for example, I remember reading that the Mayan book of Chilam Balam, which is a record of the Mayan culture, gives a detailed account of a great catastrophe to the east, which a lot of cultures in that part of the world do, which for me indicates that they were in touch with the Atlanteans. Have you got any views about that?
Well, I have to stick, like the scientist says, I'm a scientist. I have to stick to the facts. I'm an engineer, but I got to go with what I can feel and touch. And, well, I've been fascinated by the stories of Atlantis that came from the Greeks and later people, et cetera. I think there was once a city in the Mediterranean that was probably advanced and was destroyed by a tsunami or earthquake or something like that. But I do believe there was transatlantic trade between the Maya and other the Egyptians and the Indians, because they have, before Christopher Columbus ever touched the shores, they had corn and tomatoes and pineapples, etc., which are native only to the Yucatan. That's my, there was trade, but I don't have any evidence for you, and supporting evidence for Atlantis, because of the, it's a legend.
No. That's fair enough. I thought I would mention it just to see if you had come across it.
What I think. I'd love to believe in it. I got to tell you, because actually, I was part of the team that went in on and investigated the Sphinx in Cairo.
Oh, yes.
And evaluated the erosion. And erosion on the Sphinx is definitely from water, not from sand. It's the vertical erosion. And the last time there was enough water, this is according to the I'm trying to think of the name for the ancient meteorologist. Anyway, they have assessed that the last time Sahara had savannas and enough rain, it was 11,000 years ago, which is twice as long as the Egyptians had the old empire. And, I hear people talk about it, and one reason people may be objecting to thinking there may have been another society there before the Egyptians was because Egyptologists would have to start all over again. I mean, this whole civilization came out of nowhere, and somewhere around 4,000 or 5,000 BC, and nobody ever has any real clear idea of what were the developmental steps leading up to their hieroglyphics and their buildings and all that stuff.
Yes,
I do have a. And it's based on science, too. I do have a place in my heart for civilizations that are really old and disappeared before our current knowledge of history was born.
Well, that's good, at least. Their history, I think, in the sense that they appear to come out of nowhere and be a fully fledged civilization, is very much like the Egyptians, isn't it?
It is. And except we know there were 2,000 years before what we call the classic period, they were developing things. They were studying the stars. And as far as we know, the Maya had more fascination and obsession with the stars and astronomy than any other civilization. I mean, can you imagine how clear it was in Yucatan, peering into a transparent sky at night at the light show, the free nightly light show of the stars and the cosmos and the planets and visitors like comets and meteorites, and then the Milky Way itself, which was so clear that they had great legends about the Milky Way, more than, European guys, and they had their own constellations that were different, completely different. They had 13, and I think the Europeans had 12. And I'm not big in astrology. You know, I'm the astronomy part of it, where, you know, like, for instance, they were so good. They knew all this stuff and made unbelievable calculations of the periodicity of the moon and the sun and you know, Mercury and Venus that somehow in the constellation of Orion, the three stars that make up Orion's belt, they knew that one of the stars was a nebula. They knew that without optical instruments before Europeans did, and they didn't know until they had good optical instruments, not just optical instruments. Now, it wasn't Galileo that discovered it. They had to go along a little bit and develop some good ones. How they did it, I'm still working on that, but I think I got a good reason, a good solution.
Yes, it did make me wonder whether in their earlier years, since they were probably trading with these mysterious people from the East, that they might have also acquired some of their knowledge or technology as well.
Well, that's true, but they had to use their available materials to work with. I mean, it may have happened 3,000 years ago, okay, but I mean, if they brought in bronze or steel tools, the Maya, you know, would have to rely on their own resources to replace them.
Yes.
So that's maybe why they came up with the properties of jadeite, which is only found, as I said, in three places in the world, Myanmar and New Guinea and, of course, along the tectonic plates in Guatemala and Mexico. So then their writing system is so unreal, so unbelievable. It's a very difficult system. There's like 600 or 800 characters, and they are phonetic, and they're also syllabic. They're some four syllables, and some are form words. It's a really clever, well written language. In fact, all the epigraphers say they could write anything they could say. And one wag said they could have even written Gone with the Wind. But going back to their beginnings, they developed slowly. They were absolutely fascinated by the stars. And then they started naming them. And they started counting. But then they didn't know how to develop a counting method. And then how to keep track? They had to develop a method of keeping track. And they only have three symbols, a dot, a bar, and a shell-like circle that make up their whole system. And it's a really clever system of mathematics because it builds vertically with the base 20 rather than our horizontal methods with the, you know, the 10 as the decimal. But first it was the naming of stars, the counting of the stars, the unbelievable astronomical calculations, and then, of course, the writing. Then came all the other sciences and their technologies. They developed social status with the scientists and the priests, et cetera, and the rulers. They wanted better buildings, and they wanted to be able to live in cities. They didn't invent the city. It just happens. And by the way, they were not an empire. They had 50 independent city-states traded with each other. In an area of 125,000 miles. So they traded with each other. That's why the civilization lasted so long, in my opinion. They didn't have any empire that could be brought down by barbarians at the gate. Well, they didn't have any barbarians until the Aztecs came along about 300 years after they collapsed. And the need for cities and buildings brought this engineering and this technology out of their cognitive capabilities, because they were smart. They were really smart people.
Yes, indeed. Now, what did you think of the Mayan pyramids? Was there anything different about their construction, say, to Egypt?
The construction of Maya construction? Well, it's all done with small stones. I'd say small. The Maya didn't have any beasts of burden. every single beast of burden that was in North America was wiped out in what's called the Holocene extinction. The horse and the camel were actually native to North America, and they traveled, half of them traveled over the land bridge into Siberia, where they were domesticated and became the transportation power for all the empires, including the British Empire. And the southern half were wiped out in this extinction. So the Maya didn't have any beasts of burden, so they used manpower. So they had a device called the tump line, which is a device that would be supported by your head and your back. And they only made stones for building. 99% of them were 100 pounds. And a man could carry 125 pounds on his back. So these set the size for the stones used in Maya construction. Now, because they didn't just leave the stones there. They covered everything in stucco. It was made from the same cement. And this stucco is waterproof. That's why recent studies have been preserved, because these Maya arches formed such close, tight-knit structures with Maya stucco on the outside that they were waterproof for the last 1,200 years. So we had these waterproof, so they didn't have to put the bricks up real neat, but they did. And then they covered them with stucco, and they painted them beautiful, brilliant colors. And we found many, many examples of these colors still remaining in some places. But one of the things I really like is they mixed mica with the paint. So during the day, these buildings would sparkle with the sun reflecting off the mica, and at night they would glow in the moonlight. And that made the king really proud. He was really proud of his buildings and his pyramids and his temples, etc. But then the Egyptians, let me just switch over to them. They were more post and beam type of guys. You know, early British construction used a wooden column with a beam on top. I'm not talking about castles. I'm talking about other buildings. Well, even the castles were that way. But the Egyptians, even in their big buildings, that like at Luxor and at Giza, used good-sized columns, vertical elements, and big, big beams across the top that spanned, maybe 20 feet, but they were huge. They were just many hundreds of tons. And they used a brute force method, while the Maya was more of a sophisticated method of using materials for their best use, like the Romans did, like the Goths did with their Gothic arches and their domes, etc. They used more of a sensitive method. Think of all the Egyptian architecture you might have seen. It's all been pretty heavy stuff.
Yes, that's an interesting comparison there. Now, Jim, we're sort of getting to the back end of the program. Is there any part of your book, The Lost Secrets, that we haven't touched upon that you would like to mention?
Well, I'd like to mention where the readers can buy the book. They can
Amazon.com.
But besides that, I think that you just about covered everything. The water, if you didn't, I did. The water system, the buildings, and of course, and you even got the ships in there. You're the first person that talked about their trading vessels, which are pretty good size, and the bridges. You've done a good job of, and you probably read the book, which is embarrassing me sometimes. I'll talk to somebody for an hour, and they will not have even seen the book. And I go, look at page so-and-so. There's a picture of it. You know, and I didn't do that with you. You already knew what my answer was going to be. I don't think you've asked me a single question that you didn't know the answer to.
I'd like to think so, yes. Well, it's very interesting to hear you talk about your expeditions. I'm sure there's a lot more you could tell, particularly on sort of a personal level. Are you still sort of doing that type of work now, by the way?
Well, I've changed it slightly. In the last 40 years, or even the last 25 years, they being the authorities, will not let you camp out at these remote sites. They've got prohibitions out because everybody was coming in and, you know, leaving garbage and everything. So you can't camp out on the ground and build your fire and catch an iguana or a monkey or something like that. You don't like the old days. Now you stay in the little hotels or something that are nearby. Sometimes you have to go 2 or 3 hours in the morning down by canoe and then leave it closest thing to sundown to feel safe to get back to the area. I do have a condo in the northern part of the Yucatan, which we will be in next month. And I'm working on a new book that will actually touch on that subject you were so clever to ask about, the produce and the inventiveness of the Maya food system. And I think that's something good. It would be at least as good as How the Irish Saved the World, which is a popular book over here. I got to tell you.
Yeah. That's brilliant.
Yeah, right. Well,
I hope you get a lot of success with your present book and your new one when it comes along. What about a website? Have you got your own website?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. I went crazy. TheOldExplorer.com. It's one word, lowercase, The Old Explorer. And I've got, hey, you're in London or you're in Britain, right?
Yes.
Okay. The only competition I've ever had is a pub in London called The Old Explorer. They tried to take my website. Can you believe that? I told them I'm older and more exploring than they are, but they changed it slightly. But they wanted that name, and I sort of coined it about 10 or 12 years ago. I wasn't that old then, but I'm not that old now. Anyway, so, yes, I have competition there with a pub. Whoop. I'd rather be, you know, we're allies now at least, okay?
Oh, that's funny, isn't it? You would think you can actually dream up an original website address, and lo and behold, somebody else has it.
They came in and tried to take it. I'm going, and that was just, 2 years ago, 3 years ago. But I wish them luck. It sounded like a good name for a pub.
Yes, I guess so. Anyway,
so
James,
I do go down. I will be down in October. I've got the condo. I can't wait to get down there because next month I've got 2 or 3 talks, and some of them are really exciting. I'm giving one at the Explorers Club in New York. The Explorers Club is the club that, you know, Admiral Byrd and Admiral Perry and Edmund Hillary, I met him there. I'm a member, by the way, but that's not the real reason they're inviting me, is because I have some discoveries to announce, and I'm all excited.
Well, that's interesting. I think that about covers it for the moment, Jim. And I have to thank you very much for coming on. It's been a very interesting talk, particularly as I rather like the Mayan period anyway. So it's a subject that interested me.
Well, you know, when America found out there was a really brilliant civilization that developed in the jungle just south of, you know, our borders, I mean, we fell in love with them. They're part of America. They're part of our history. And we're proud of them.
Yes, why not? Okay,
why not?
Thank you very much, Jim, for coming on. It's been very nice speaking with you.
Well, call me again. We might find something else to talk about.
Well, if you get your new book out, we would, yes.
Okay, Mike.
Right. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, and good night.
Thank you, Jim. Good night. Well, friends, that was something a little bit different, but extremely interesting. My guest next week will be Leda Green. She has been on in recent times. She is a rather special being in my estimation. She is a healer, and she has a almost unique method where she scans people's brains and she sees people as an energy. And she heals by a process by fixing their energies where they need it. And she told us before that she can go by thought to anyone, anywhere. So if people phone her up for healing, she can actually go into their mind and she can then think positively and give them healing in that way. So it will be interesting to hear what she's been up to and have a little bit more information. So thank you for being with me today. I hope you can make it next week. Thank you very much. God bless you all.